1 Samuel chapter 23, please. And I hope you have a handout to follow along as we continue in this study. We're getting close to the end of this study, but not the end of the opportunity to use it. We're being equipped together. I love having my father-in-law and brother-in-law, Ed, come to visit from Davison. Why? Because my wife and I usually have a list of things that need fixed or repaired or replaced that I don't know how to do. You know, I can help them with Bible interpretation. I can help them with maybe selection of a pocket knife. But as far as building and all that, I don't have the skills they have. And sure enough, we knew Lori's brother was coming this week, and we had a big to-do item. The bathroom fan in our guest room, it was rattling, and it wasn't clearing out the moisture. And we thought for sure we just had to replace the fan. So we said, hey, Ed, this is on Saturday. We're like, hey, let's go to Home Depot just real quick, buy a fan, and let's go put it in, you know? And after that, we'll go to Cabela's or something. And he said, okay. He's wise on this stuff. He says, first of all, I'd like to get up in your attic and just look around for a minute.
I'm like, yeah, okay, go ahead.
And he went up there, and he pulled me up into the attic, too. And he says, Jim, he says, the duct work has pulled away from the fan, and it's pulled out from the side of the house. No fan's going to work like this. And he did some miracle work with duct tape and elbow grease. And needless to say, we got to go right out to the store after that, and it wasn't Home Depot. It was fixed. The problem was fixed. But I remember when I first climbed up in the attic with him. You know, he's moving around like a monkey up there because he's just used to that. And as soon as I got up there, he said, hey, just do me a favor. Be careful where you step. You got to stay on the rafters, right? Because if you step between the rafters, what's going to happen? Your leg's going down into the ceiling, okay? And he said, just watch where you walk. Walk carefully and lightly. And he was right, and I managed to pull it off and didn't go through the roof. You say, what does that have to do with the study tonight? Our study tonight is how to minister to someone who's grieving. And I want my illustration to kind of lob a caution into our midst tonight as we study this topic. If someone within your reach is grieving, either it's really out there that they're grieving, or they're quietly grieving and no one would know except you because you know them so well, when you enter that scene to minister to someone who's grieving, be careful where you step. Walk lightly and carefully. Even old Shakespeare himself gives us some wisdom on this. Shakespeare wrote these words, "Everyone can master a grief, but he who has it." If someone's heart is grieving, you might have the right answers to give to them, but you're going to have to be patient. As a matter of fact, Proverbs said, before Shakespeare ever wrote anything, Proverbs said, the heart knows its own bitterness. You mean well, and these are the right answers we're going to talk about. For any heart that's grieving, just walk carefully. Don't go bouncing in. You might step on something that might do more damage than be helpful. Under the introduction here, I just want to point out that grieving is focusing on one of the following. And you'll see that all three options are going to have one word in common. When someone is grieving, whether it's a genuine grieving that's not sinful, or whether it's a grieving that has given way to despair and depression, they all have one focus in common, and it's one type of loss. This is a huge word. As a matter of fact, a new book was just written in the biblical counseling movement on how critical, how important this topic of loss is as we try to diagnose our own hearts, let alone help others. So when someone's grieving, even when someone has gone beyond grieving to despair and to depression, it's because of a meditation on a loss. You say, what kind of losses? Well, number one, you have an actual loss. This is a loss that's real. Someone that used to be in your life is gone. Perhaps death has taken them. Perhaps the dating relationship has ended. Or perhaps in 2008 or in 2005, there was great financial loss. Really, there are zeros disappearing from your balance in your retirement. I had one guy in the church that gave me way more information than I ever needed to know. But he said back around 2005 or so, when that thing went south, when the markets really got hit hard, I mean, he lost over $200,000 of his retirement. He was deep in his retirement. That's a real loss. That's an actual loss. So you have actual losses. This is where someone or something used to be there. Perhaps it was a ministry position. Maybe it was an employment position. This is a real loss. There's a vacuum that used to be filled. But there's a second kind of loss that can find us grieving or even pushing beyond grief to despair and to depression. Number two is what I call a potential loss. The person's still in your life, but there's a real possibility that they won't be soon in the future. There's a real possibility that those funds won't be there anymore because of a market downturn or because of insurance or a health crisis you're entering into. It could be that you got news about your health, and it's not that your health is broken yet, but you just got news, and if we go down this road pretty far, then your health will be lost. These are not losses that are already in front of us and they've actually happened, but they are potential losses that we can begin to meditate on, to fixate on. It could be a dynamic in your relationship, in your marriage, in your parenting. It's not that it's happened yet, but it could. So you have an actual loss. You have potential loss. Or number three, I want to call this one a perceived loss. In other words, the loss hasn't happened, but you're convinced it has. In other words, that person hasn't walked out of your life, but you're convinced practically they have. You haven't lost that position, but in your mind, you have. That's a perceived loss. It's not an actual loss. It hasn't happened. It's not even a potential loss. It's just your perception of a loss. But mark it down. Whenever we are focusing, whenever, as Jim Berg says, whenever we are meditating on a loss, we are on the road, not just to grieving. We're going to see that grieving isn't necessarily sin. We're going to see that tonight. But we are on the road to despair, which is grieving without hope, which can take you into a spiritual depression. Loss is always the common denominator, right? It's very important to remember that. What's an example to follow? We'd like to look at an example for each one of these studies we're doing in towel supply. And this one's kind of an interesting, quick case study. It's not the only one we could have gone to, but I put in your notes here, one of the most beloved examples of comforting the grieving springs from the friendship of David and Jonathan. You know that friendship. We see it at its very inception when David kills Goliath, and then he comes to report to Saul. He's still holding Goliath's head, and in that moment, Jonathan's heart was knit to David. That was the beginning of a deep, deep friendship, one of the deepest friendships we read about in both Testaments. And it's one that really never wavers once, never wavers. And so I want to take you to one particular episode, and we're in 1 Samuel chapter 23, and as you know, and I don't want to make light of this, but we know several things of Saul, King Saul, and one of the things that's always true of him is he's always trying to find David. It seems like we're always reading where he's looking for David. David's hiding in a city, Saul's going after that city. David's hiding in the cave or in the wilderness, he's going after David. He's always looking for David, and he can never find David. Why? Well, look at verse 14 of 1 Samuel 23. David stayed in the wilderness in the strongholds and remained in the hill country in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul sought him every day. But God did not deliver him into his hand. You want to know why Saul could never find David as hard as he looked for him all the time? David was protecting him. God was protecting David. God was concealing him and blinding Saul to his location. God had his back, as we would say. But I find it interesting. Saul looked all the time for David. He wanted to find David to kill him. Can't find him. But when Jonathan wants to find David, he doesn't have to look hard. He knows where to find him. I always find that interesting. Look at verse 15. Now David became aware that Saul had come out to seek his life while David was in the wilderness of Ziph at Horesh. And Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and just went to David at Horesh and encouraged him in God. I love that phrase. He encouraged him in God. And thus he said to him, "Do not be afraid, because the hand of Saul, my father, will not find you, and you will be king over Israel, and I will be next to you. And Saul, my father, knows that also." So the two of them made a covenant before the Lord, and David stayed at Horesh while Jonathan, well, he just went home. I love that. His dearest friend knew right where to find him, though Saul couldn't find him at all. I find this an interesting potential case study for ministering to someone who's grieving. You see, at one point, David did have a place at Saul's table, so to speak. He was in the good graces of Saul. Saul even made him his bodyguard. He was already a young, mighty warrior, a successful special ops guy, if you will, who was also a keen musician, who was used to not only fight Saul's enemies, but to fight the evil spirit from the Lord that tormented Saul. And David would fight with his music, not his sword. And so he'd been at a place where there was great freedom and even great success and leading God's people out to war, and he lost that. He could focus on that, perhaps, as a loss. He was on the run. He was away from family. He was away from those that he wanted to be with. And there's a real possibility that David was grieving, that he was grieving a loss. And I don't think that's a stretch at all, because if we read some of the Psalms that were written during this time, I'll not take the time to do that in this study right now, but there are plenty. I mean, he's calling out with phrases like, "How long, Lord?" So here's a guy that most likely is grieving. He's grieving the fact that Saul, someone he loves, someone he's so loyal to, wants to kill him. And Jonathan goes into action. And I just want to point out here four important ways to comfort someone who is sorrowing. And we see this in Jonathan's example. First of all, number one, it's simple. Search them out. He knew right where to find David. Now, it's not going to be an inconvenient trip. He's going to have to go when Saul's not looking. He's going to have to go when Saul's minions are not watching. It's probably going to be a long trip where he himself will be exposed. Remember, Saul was already at different points not trusting even Jonathan. But Jonathan said, "I must get to David," and he searched him out. And let me say this about people who are grieving. If I read Psalm 55 correctly, and this is a psalm of the psalm writer David saying, "I wish I could, when my enemy's after me, I wish I could just grow wings and fly away and be free from what is tormenting me. I want to get out of here." Someone who's grieving honestly struggles often with isolating themselves. It's getting away. They may do it quietly. They may do it with publicity by their post on social media, or they just suddenly stop showing up at things, and they're grieving. They're grieving. If you're a Jonathan, you'll notice that, and you will search them out. Number two, what do I see from Jonathan? Hear them out. Now, it's here that I can only imagine, and I'm using my imagination for point two, but it's not a far-fetched point, and it's this. David's heart is so full whenever he is hiding from Saul, whenever he is hiding from his enemies, and mainly that's going to be Saul or his minions, his heart is so full that it erupts with psalms. With songs, if you will. And we have those psalms to read. Psalms of heaviness. Psalms of trust. But even in the trust, he's still putting out there the heaviness of his heart. And no doubt, as Jonathan engages David, he hears him out. And what's coming out in the psalms came out in these intimate conversations when Jonathan was encouraging David in God, as it says at the end of verse 16. In order to encourage, you have to first hear them out. And Proverbs 18 says, "If you answer a matter before you hear, it's a folly and a shame." Listen, just listen. I don't usually quote Mormons in church, but many of you who are in the business world know the name Stephen Covey. The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, and he also wrote another book called The Eighth Habit. There's some good wisdom and leadership stuff in those books, and I love this one, and it's not unique to Stephen. It was in the book of Proverbs first, but one of his habits of highly effective people is this: seek first to hear and then be understood. Listen to people. Listen to them. Repeat back to them what's on their heart. Number three, express your confidence in God's promises. The blank there is the word promises, but probably the most important word in number three is the word your. Because oftentimes when someone is grieving, they can't see real well. And I'm not talking about their glasses. I'm not talking about the fine print. When someone's meditating on either an actual or a potential or a perceived loss, that's where they are fixated. There's almost like a tunnel vision on that loss. You know this to be true. You and I do this too. And often, you'll hear statements like this, and perhaps you've made these statements as well, as I have. Statements like, I just can't see straight right now. I just can't make sense of life right now. That's another way of saying, I'm fixated on this actual or potential or perceived loss that I can't focus my attention out here, and I just feel like my faith is small if it's there at all. I remember the name R. Kent Hughes. He wrote the book Disciplines of a Godly Man. Many of you have read his books, his commentaries. Phil, you're using his commentary on Mark for your class. Kent Hughes, before he had his long pastorate at College Church in Wheaton, he was involved in a church planning effort on the West Coast. And boy, was it a difficult assignment. I mean, early on in that ministry, it really got tough. And the toughness wasn't a financial toughness. It was being attacked by his people, the people he came to serve. And it was very hard. And he was a very young pastor. And he says in his book, the book is called, Lori, I forgot the name of it, Liberating Ministry from the Success Syndrome. He tells the story in that book. And he came to his wife, Barbara, who's just a real godly lady, feisty, godly lady. And he said to her, I just can't see straight. I don't even know if I have enough faith to keep this thing of pastoring up. I love what Barbara said back to him. She said, I understand you're discouraged, and I understand that you can't even see straight with the eye of faith right now. And then she said this, so go ahead right now while we're in this storm and hold on to my faith. I love that. And someone who's grieving, don't chastise them for they're meditating on an actual or potential or perceived loss right away. What if they can't see straight, just say, okay, I want to tell you some really awesome things about God right now that I believe. And just hold on to my faith right now. I'll be here for you. But let's walk through this. So express your confidence in God's promises. That's what Jonathan does in verse 17. He says, don't be afraid. He's stating his faith to David. Do not be afraid, because the hand of Saul, my father, will not find you. And you will be king over Israel, and I will be next to you. And Saul, my father, knows that also. He's giving four statements of his faith. And he's basically saying, David, while you're in this cave, hold on to my faith. Hold on to my faith. And then number four, and this is just one example we could have chosen, but number four, make commitments to God in prayer. Pray with them. And you express in prayer your faith that you have in God to see your friend through. Verse 18, the two of them made a covenant before the Lord. And then David stayed where he was and Jonathan went home. I think this is a beautiful example to follow. You say, well, what do we talk about over the many coffees that will follow this? There's going to be several meetings, and you're going to leave some meetings. You'll be encouraged. They'll be encouraged. You're going to leave some of your coffees with a grieving person, and they're going to be discouraged, and you're going to be discouraged. But you keep going back. You keep having another coffee. You keep having another tea. But what do you discuss? What do you discuss? So I want to give you some topics to discuss. And if I get through these tonight, great. If I don't, this is where we'll pick up next time. Keep your notes. I want to suggest to you, as I give you in this point, this Roman numeral, a theology of suffering is what this is going to be, that if these verses are true that we're going to look at, if these passages are true, and they are, then it means this, that these are the realities in your life, the eight realities in your life that are true for every Christian when they go through any trial. These are true for any Christian, whether they go through an actual loss, or they're facing a potential loss, or even just a perceived loss. These realities are true for any child of God. And these are topics to discuss, not over one coffee. You might discuss one of these over three coffees. But I think that this material that we're going to see in Scripture will give you plenty to talk about and pray through with them. So first of all, letter A, in my life as a believer, in your life as a believer, trials give us an eternal perspective. Trials give us an eternal perspective. Now for this one, look with me in Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8, an amazing passage from Paul's pen. It's in the last part of that section of Romans dealing with progressive sanctification. You know, chapter 6, we're told that we are to act consistently with who we are in Christ. Chapter 7, you have Paul giving his personal testimony after 25 years in the ministry. He still struggles every day, every moment with his own sin. And there's something missing in chapter 7 that just explodes into chapter 8 as Paul continues this discussion, and it's the presence and ministry of the Holy Spirit. And as he gets to the end of chapter 8, he starts declaring his full confidence in the work of God in his life as a believer to make him more like Jesus. And he ends this chapter with praise over the unbreakable love of God. But it's in the midst of this discussion, you come to verse 18. It's a verse you know well. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us. That is an outstanding verse of hope. This verse and others like it teach us that trials give us an eternal perspective. You say, what do you mean by that? What's Paul saying? He's saying, I understand that the more I hurt here, whether it's actual or potential or perceived, the more I hurt here, the more I suffer here, it's not even worthy to be on the same stage with the glory that I will experience in the presence of Christ one day. No comparison. So what's he saying? Well, you, as bad as it can get here, as high as the volume of your suffering continues to go up, you say, will this ever max out? And sometimes it feels like you can never max out how deep the suffering will go. I don't know if it'll ever max out, but I know this, as high as you turn up the volume of your suffering, it's still not worthy to be on the same stage to compare with the glory that we'll see with Christ someday. Actually, could it be that we learn from this verse that the suffering we're going through here just keeps us from getting too comfortable here? When I was pastoring there in North Carolina, my kids were very young, and sometimes I'd take my son on a visit with me on say a Tuesday afternoon or something. I'll say, hey, Jared, you want to go with me to a nursing home or something to visit someone? And, you know, a little child's not always excited about that, so I learned how to manipulate him. Hey, you want to go to Walmart? Sure, Dad. And of course, on the way to Walmart and on the way home, I might stop and do a visit on the way to Walmart and on the way home from Walmart. And bless his heart, sometimes little Jared, he would get fidgety, but he'd always be polite. But we'd get in the car and he would finally start saying, Dad, is it time to go home yet? I've had enough. Walmart was not the major part of this trip. Is it time to go home? Poor guy was suffering. Wanted to go home and play. But in his suffering, so to speak, hanging out with people that might not always be pleasant to be around for a little boy, it was just making him homesick for home. He just wanted to go home. Homes where he wanted to be. Homes where he felt safe. Homes where his happiness was. I think that's just a great illustration of what Paul's trying to teach us here. The more we hurt here, with the physical report we get from our doctor, with the relationships that are broken, with the struggles financially or socially, the more we hurt here, it just has us asking, God, can I come home? Not that I'm going to usher that in before it's time, but I just want you to know, God, that I'm hurting and I'm ready to be with you someday where I won't hurt anymore, but I will be taking in your resplendent glory. It just keeps us from getting too comfortable down here. Romans 8:18. Trials give us an eternal perspective. But there's a second reality about our trials. Another topic to discuss. You see, in your life, in my life as a Christian, every trial, without exception, cleanses us of personal sin. Letter B, it cleanses us from personal sin. Go to the right in the New Testament a few books to Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12. I love really the whole first half of the chapter of 12 dealing with the fact that our Lord loves us and disciplines us far beyond the best earthly dad. And he does it for the sake of us becoming sanctified, becoming more and more holy. Look at verse 9. Furthermore, we had earthly fathers to discipline us, and we respected them. Shall we not much rather be subject to the Father of spirits and live, live accordingly with that knowledge? Look at verse 10. For they, our earthly fathers, disciplined us for a short time as seemed best to them. But he, our heavenly Father, disciplines us for our good. Why? So that we may share his holiness. Now, remember what I said. Sometimes these losses come into your life, maybe because you bring them on and they're a consequence of sin. Yes, that's a possibility. But sometimes these losses come in and it's not a direct consequence to a sinful choice on your part. I mean, the market crashes. Cancer happens. Other people's commitments and relationships disintegrates. And it's not that you brought this on, but you understand, even in a loss that I might experience that I didn't bring on as a consequence to my sin, sometimes I will sinfully react to that loss that my sin didn't bring in. I can react with blaming God. I can react with being sinfully angry at someone who sinned like that. And it's not that I co-sinned with someone, or it's not that I sinned and brought these consequences on, but I can sometimes, and you can too, sin in reaction to a loss. I can introduce you to friends of mine, and you can introduce me to friends of yours who have walked out of their faith. They've walked out of their church. They've broken ranks with their local assembly, all because they're angry about something that God allowed into their lives. And sometimes this type of a trial, not one that we brought on, but one that we definitely compound with our sinful reaction, God will continue to address us. Because that trial brought out of our heart something that God wanted to cleanse. And our hearts and the sin in our heart would not have been out on the table for God to deal with, so to speak, had he not lovingly allowed the trial into our life to expose our heart. So in my life as a child of God, trials cleanse us of personal sin. They expose our hearts so that God can cleanse them through his loving fatherly discipline so that, verse 10, we may share his holiness. Let's try to get one or two more in. Thirdly, in my life and in your life as a Christian, trials build in us tough endurance. They build in us tough endurance. Now, you're almost there. Go with me to James chapter 1. James chapter 1, and I so look forward to studying this whole epistle with you in the future. It's one of the most life-changing studies I've personally done is this epistle, especially when you know the background of it. But for right now, I just want to direct your attention to verses 2-4. He's right out of the gate. This is Jesus' little brother, Joseph and Mary's oldest son next to Jesus. He's writing these words. I find it interesting. He doesn't even identify himself as the brother of Jesus. Verse 1, I'm a slave. I'm a doulos. I'm a bondservant of God, and I'm a bondservant of my older brother, the Lord Jesus Christ. To the 12 tribes who are dispersed abroad, greetings. And then he goes right for the heart. Verse 2, consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. But it's interesting. Notice verse 3 doesn't end. The thought doesn't end with verse 3. It's not, the ultimate end game is not endurance. No, endurance is the vehicle that without which we cannot make it to the final destination. Endurance is not the end goal. It's a vehicle to carry you to the end goal. And if there's no suffering, there can be no endurance and therefore no end goal. What's the end goal of endurance? Verse 4. Let endurance have its perfect result so that you may be perfect or mature and complete, lacking nothing. So it's like this. You got to have suffering, James says. Suffering produces endurance, but that's still not the end. And by the way, if you don't suffer, you don't develop endurance. You suffer and your patience and the Spirit keeping you in those trials builds endurance. But endurance is the vehicle that takes you on to maturity, Christlikeness. If there's no endurance, there can be no Christlikeness. If there's no suffering, there can be no endurance. And watch this. What you face today, which is difficult, and it is, no one's saying it's small. No one's saying that your loss is insignificant. Okay, no one's saying that. But what you've lost, what you're grieving today is real. But as you endure, do you understand that Jesus is taking this suffering and making you more like him through your endurance? But understand this as well. This is just for today's grieving. This is just for today's loss. But understand this. As you grow, as you endure, and as you grow to be more like Jesus because of your endurance today, do you understand what you suffer tomorrow, you'll have more muscle for, spiritually speaking. What you suffer next year, in a very real sense, will build on the endurance and the maturity that you're developing today. When I was in ninth grade, I tried a new sport. Okay, I was always a soccer player, and I always did karate, like in middle school and the early part of high school. Those were my sports. I wasn't excellent at either one, but I enjoyed both of them. And then our school, this is back in the days of Max. I don't even know if Max is still around, Michigan Association of Christian Schools, but they introduced in the 80s wrestling. Well, the Braunlichs, wrestling, okay? And I was like, well, I'll go out for wrestling. I mean, that's a contact sport. I like contact sports. This was back around 1982. I was in ninth grade. I don't remember what year it was. And I was like, yeah, I'll go out for wrestling. And I had a bunch of guys that had transferred in from Clarkson High School and Waterford High School, and they had wrestled in middle school at their schools, and they were warriors. They were great. They knew all the moves. And I came in. I didn't know anything. And what few moves I knew were illegal on the mat. And I came in with a little strut. I'm like, I'm a green belt in karate. Yeah. You guys are glad I'm here now, right? I'm on the team, right? And I walked in and I had the sweats on, long sleeve sweatshirt, sweatpants, and we started the workout. Now I thought I was in shape from soccer and karate. When the wrestling coach started working us out for wrestling, I thought the man was insane. We would run, we would do up downs. I mean, he killed us in practice. And I had this attitude. Not only was I supposed to be a gift to the wrestling mat for Springfield Christian Academy, but I'm like, this coach doesn't know what he's doing. You don't need to work us this hard. Teach us the techniques like in karate, man. And so I had this attitude. I started spreading it around. But I almost quit, but I was like, no, I'm going to stay with it. And for like 2 or 3 weeks before our first match, David Vanaman just killed us in practices. And I didn't understand at all until our first wrestling tournament, which was at Temple Baptist in Redford, which is a different name now, I guess. And we walked in there, and suddenly your blood's pumping, you're nervous. And then I find out who I'm going to wrestle from Temple Baptist in Redford. It was a guy a head taller than me and skinny but strong. And I'm like, how can he be in my weight division? You know? So I'm nervous. And we go out there when it's our turn for our match. And I don't know what I know like four moves, you know? And I just know I'm not allowed to kick him. Don't kick him. Okay. And wouldn't you know it? Those four moves help me. I could get out from the bottom of whatever what's that referee position or whatever thing. I had a few moves to get out of that. And you know what? Before you knew it, I made it to the end of the match. And because of a few reversals and stuff, I won. And I jumped out. I had cotton mouth. I could hardly walk. I was dead tired. I used every ounce of my energy the whole match. And I just kind of stumbled over to the corner and I went right to my coach, Dave Vanaman. I said, thank you. Thank you. Had you not pushed me like you did for those 3 weeks, I never would have survived this guy. You see, the suffering from the past only created an endurance and a maturity that I needed today. And today's suffering and endurance and maturity is building strength, spiritual strength and spiritual toughness in me and in you for what you're going to suffer tomorrow. Listen, if I were to tell you, if I could look into your future and tell you what you are going to suffer in the next 3 years, you personally, if I could tell you what struggles you're going to go through as a family, what struggles you're going to go through with your resources, with other people, with ministry, it would frighten you. It would absolutely horrify you and me. But I do know this. We do tomorrow tomorrow. Today, we're suffering. We will suffer. Every one of us will suffer. We'll go through losses and we endure it. And that endurance carries us on to maturity. Without exception, trials build in us tough endurance. I'll get one more in, all right? Number four, I'm giving you a theology of suffering. You don't discuss all this over one coffee. This is what you reach for, though, over the season of many coffees. In my life as a believer, in your life as a believer, without exception, trials reveal to us our values. They reveal to us our values. If I were to ask you, who is the person in Scripture who went through one of the biggest moments of suffering, biggest seasons of suffering, outside of Jesus? Outside of Jesus. Some of us may think back to the disciples and some of the persecution they endured in the book of Acts. We may think of what church history tells us happened to Paul and Peter and the other apostles and their martyrdom, or John in his exile. Some of us, our minds may run back to the Old Testament, to Job. I mean, can you imagine getting his news where his children are gone, his assets are gone, his health is gone, all in the same season? He didn't see it coming. We would say, yeah, that man suffered. And then he had his friends show up, and it only went downhill from there. But I agree with John MacArthur, who says when someone asks him who suffered the most, who had the darkest moment in his life, he goes past Job all the way back to Genesis. Genesis chapter 22. Look at verse 1. Now it came about after these things that God tested Abraham. And he said to him, Abraham, and he said, here am I. And he said, take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you. Yeah, I think MacArthur's probably right. We are entering a very dark moment for Abraham. Wait, this is my son. You've given a 4-point introduction to my son you're talking about, Lord. It's my son. It's my only son. It's the son that I love, and it's a son whose name is Laughter. And I have to kill him? It's not just one thing for me to find out he's killed. See, Job found out he lost his family. God's telling Abraham, you lift your hand with the knife. This is dark. Verse 3, so Abraham rose early in the morning. He saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him and Isaac his son. And he split wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. No hesitation. And on the third day, Abraham raised his eyes and saw the place from a distance. And Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go over there, and we will worship and return to you. The author of Hebrews is going to look back at this and say this was an amazing statement of faith in the resurrection. But Abraham, he doesn't have Hebrews to read in the New Testament yet. So we have to go on to verse 6. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son, and he took it in his hand, the fire and the knife. So the two of them walked on together, and Isaac spoke to Abraham his father and said, my father. And he said, here am I, my son. And he said, behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? And Abraham said, God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. So the two of them walked on together. What's going through his mind? Every step. I mean, there'll have to come a point if this is going to be a follow through where he will have to lay hands on his son that has, and his son's walking by him with amazing trust and love for his dad. And it does come to that point. Verse 9, then they came to the place of which God had told him, and Abraham built the altar there and arranged the wood, and he bound his son. And he laid his son on the altar on top of the wood, and Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. Yes, this is a dark moment. Verse 11, but the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here I am. He said, do not stretch out your hand against the lad and do nothing to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. And Abraham raised his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the place of his son. Important phrase. And Abraham called the name of that place, the Lord will provide, as it is said to this day, in the mount of the Lord it will be provided. Wow. I love verse 12. I love how the whole thing's ending here. But verse 12, he says, don't do this. Don't follow through with obeying me. Why? Look at verse 12. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. It's one thing for Abraham to trust God's promises. It's another thing for Abraham to declare his loyalty, his fear, his love for God. But it's quite another thing to demonstrate it in the darkest moments. And he was willing to do that. And God says, that's enough. That's enough. Now I know that you fear me. You see, trials reveal to us our values. Notice how I'm trying to word that. I didn't word it that it reveals to God. God needed Abraham to see and take note of this amazing obedience and fear of God that God had placed in Abraham's heart. And this trial was revelatory, not so much to God as it was even to Abraham. God knew what the outcome was going to be, and it was God that gave him this faith. It's God that chose him to be the head of his people. Well, I'm going to keep my promise to you. I think already you have enough for several coffees. You have enough right now to be a Jonathan to a David. You already have that David's face in your mind. It might be a lady. It might be a man. It might be a child. It might be an elderly person. But they're grieving. And you know now that grieving comes from meditating on an actual or a potential or a perceived loss. Know the difference of the losses. remember Jonathan's example, and now you have at least 4 points to your theology of suffering that over time and over several living room visits or hospital room visits or coffees, you can begin to express your confidence in God so that a grieving person can hold on to your faith while they go through this valley. Well, would you stand with me as we close in a word of prayer? I hope you have a wonderful evening. It's been a great day to worship together here at Calvary. God has been so kind to us.